From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowain. On today's Fresh Air, writer and Nobel Peace Prize winner Elie Wiesel, the world's foremost living witness to the degradations of Auschwitz and Buchenwald. In 1944, when he was 15, all of the Jews in his small Hungarian town were deported to concentration camps. Both his parents and one of his sisters died in the Nazi camps. Wiesel's new memoirs, All Rivers Run to the Sea, will be published next month. Also, linguist Jeffrey Nunberg looks at the value a name can have if it's displayed in the right place. All that on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. President Clinton says congressional Republicans are using today's shutdown of federal government agencies to try to force enactment of a budget plan that Mr. Clinton says would be bad for America.
We can balance the budget without doing what they seek to do. We can balance the budget without the deep cuts in education, without the deep cuts in the environment, without letting Medicare wither on the vine, without imposing tax increases on the hardest-pressed working families in America. I am fighting for a balanced budget that is good for America and consistent with our values. If they'll give me the tools, I'll balance the budget.
Mr. Clinton was speaking just a few moments ago in the White House press room. John Sturdivant of the Government Employees Union says the political stalemate between the president and Congress is going to have a direct impact on millions of Americans.
Congress doesn't care if your grandmother's Social Security check is lost or stolen. They've just closed the nation's 1,300 Social Security offices and shut off the agency's 1-800 helpline. Don't even think about filing a new retirement or disability claim because your needs will have to wait while Congress throws another temper tantrum.
Sturdivant says his organization is going to court to seek a temporary restraining order to stop the furlough of government workers. Suspected serial killer Glenn Rogers was in court in Richmond, Kentucky today, but he said nothing. He's been ordered held without bond until another hearing next week. Ron Smith of member station WEKU reports.
Because of security concerns, Rogers was arraigned via closed-circuit TV from the Madison County Detention Center. District Judge William Klaus conducted the five-minute hearing.
Mr. Rogers, you're charged with numerous charges from another state, crimes from other states. And it's my understanding that the state of California, the state of Florida, the state of Louisiana, and the state of Mississippi have arrest warrants out pending, and there is a fugitive arrest warrant pending against you presently in the state of Kentucky.
Judge Klaus asked Rogers if he wanted to waive his right of extradition. His court-appointed attorney said he did not. Judge Klaus says no bond is being set because of the seriousness of the charges. Rogers has invoked his right to remain silent. Klaus has set a November 21st date for preliminary and extradition hearings. For National Public Radio, I'm Ron Smith in Richmond, Kentucky.
Secretary of State Warren Christopher is meeting with all three Balkan presidents today at the Bosnian peace talks in Ohio as he searches for common ground that could lead to a settlement to end the war. He'll hold meetings until midnight when he'll board an Air Force jet to fly to Japan for a meeting on Pacific Rim trade. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up just over 9 points at 4881.93 in active trading. This is NPR News. The Pentagon says the bomb that ripped into a U.S. military facility in Riyadh Monday weighed between 150 and 225 pounds. A team of 19 FBI agents and two State Department security experts has arrived in Saudi Arabia to assist in the investigation of the blast, which killed five Americans and injured 37. A United Nations report says the number of plant and animal species that are disappearing from the planet is increasing at an alarming rate. NPR's Joe Palca has more.
The UN report is being presented at an international meeting in Jakarta, Indonesia. According to the report, some 9,400 plant and animal species are facing extinction. While that number may seem high, Tom Lovejoy of the Smithsonian Institution says it's really not.
This assessment made every attempt to be just as conservative as possible. So the problem is likely to be considerably larger.
The UN report warns that biological resources are disappearing at a faster rate than ever before, largely due to human activities. The loss of these resources threatens global food supplies, as well as limiting the potential for the discovery of new medicines. The delegates meeting in Jakarta will be looking for ways to reverse some of the most alarming trends. This is Joe Palca in Washington.
The boards of three companies that make silicone breast implants have ratified a new multi-billion-dollar settlement, but fewer women will be covered, and those that are will get less than under a previous settlement agreement, which collapsed because of an unexpectedly high number of claims. Benefits to women will range from $10,000 to $250,000, depending on the severity of their health problems. The women claim the implants have caused severe illnesses. The manufacturers insist the implants are safe. At least half of the 440,000 women involved in the previous settlement will not be eligible under this new plan because their implants were made by Dow Corning, which has filed for bankruptcy. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. For 50 years, Elie Wiesel has been keeping alive the memory of the horror of the Holocaust. His parents and younger sister died in Nazi concentration camps, but he survived the year he spent in Auschwitz and Buchenwald. He was 16 when the Allies defeated the Germans and liberated the death camps. Wiesel became a journalist and then went on to write more than 30 books, including many novels. The first, published in 1958 called Night, is about a teenage boy racked with guilt for having survived the concentration camps and devastated that the God he worshipped had let so many die. Wiesel has received many awards, including the Nobel Peace Prize in 1986. His latest book is a memoir titled All Rivers Run to the Sea. In it, he writes, among many other things, about his friendship with Yitzhak Rabin, the Israeli prime minister who was just assassinated by a Jewish Israeli law student. I asked Elie Wiesel his reaction when he heard about Rabin's death.
Oh, I was shocked. More than that, I was paralyzed. Somehow I couldn't believe it. It took me many minutes, maybe many hours, before I realized that what I heard was true. One of those nightmares.
Well, certainly what many people are trying to understand and, in a sense, reeling from is the fact that Rabin was murdered by another Jew, Yigal Amir, who was an Israeli law student. Were you as shocked as everybody else?
Of course. I was shocked in general that he was killed, then that he was killed by a Jew. But something on a historical level, we lost something in history. This man was a very important figure in history. He was a soldier, a great soldier, a glorious soldier, and he brought to Israel Jerusalem. He brought to Israel triumphs that Israel never had. And for him to become a man of peace, a messenger of peace, was more than a miracle. It was a human endeavor, a human accomplishment. And in addition to all that, I knew him well since 1967, and we were very good friends. I had seen him 10 days earlier.
There was a demonstration where Rabin was depicted in a Nazi SS uniform. Do you understand that kind of hatred, that kind of depiction?
Oh, no. Hatred is always irrational. It's blind and blinding. I found it obscene. I found it grotesque. I found it scandalous. Why they went so far as saying Rabin murderer. Rabin saved people. He saved the people of Israel in 67. Furthermore, to say Rabin Petain and then Rabin SS, oh, I think they discredited themselves for many years, and their ideas and their theories and their beliefs will have to be questioned in the light of these obscene propaganda.
I'm wondering whether you see this as one of the legacies of the Holocaust, not to excuse it, but rather to explain the behavior that, for some people, the Holocaust has led to a deep sense of victimhood, a deep sense of rage, and a deep sense of desperation, one so powerful that it could justify murder.
I don't accept that.
Why not?
I think the Holocaust should never be used in politics, nor in anything else. It defies any human endeavor today. It defies imagination, it defies words, it defies language, it defies whatever we can do with ourselves, because it was so extraordinary. It was a unique tragedy. However, surely those who use, quote-unquote, the Holocaust for murder, I think are beyond the pale.
In your memoirs, you do detail some events in Jewish history when Jews turned on Jews, the Jewish capos beating other Jews in the concentration camps. Is that in any way comparable to what happened in Israel?
No. Well, murder is murder. But you cannot compare. The capos were victims too, after all. They were Jews, and as Jews, they were sentenced to death by Hitler and his acolytes. Therefore, I am not so harsh on the Judenelsters, the Judenrat, what they call them, the Council of the Jews in the ghettos, or the capos. There were very few. Some were brutal, cruel, inhuman, but there were very, very few. And even they, in the end, they too were killed. In this case, you have a young man who lived in a free, independent, sovereign land. He should be grateful to what is happening in Israel, grateful that after 2,000 years of exile, Israel exists as a sovereign land. And for him, therefore, to abuse that sovereignty by killing the man who incarnated, the man who symbolized the sovereignty of Israel as prime minister, was wrong, was crazy, was criminally crazy.
In a democracy, what then can be done with extremist groups, those that speak out against the government and against the peace process?
Speak out as their liberty. I believe in democracy. There is no substitute to democracy. And it's good that people speak for and against. I am not saying that those who oppose the peace process are traitors. Never would I say that. I think they are patriots just like the others are. But no violence. Violence occurs only when language dies. If people can no longer talk to each other, or when they use a language which is an anti-language, like the obscene pictures about Rabin, then violence occurs. So we have, I think, to reestablish everywhere in America, in the American Jewish community, and in Israel. But who am I to give advice to Israelis? I who don't live there. But we should reestablish a kind of civility and humanity in our discourse and in our debates.
My guest is Elie Wiesel, and he's just written his memoirs called All Rivers Run to the Sea. Well, I do want to talk about your life, and certainly you write about it in your memoirs. You grew up in a town in Hungary, a shtetl, as you say, a typical shtetl called Sziget.
It's a very strange shtetl, you know, because it was when my father was born, it was Austro-Hungary. When I was born, it was Romania. When I left it, it was Hungary. Now it's Romania again. So go now.
Okay.
Go
all right. Well,
find your way in.
But the town, describe.
It's called Sziget. It was a really typical Jewish town at that time. I think there were some 25,000 inhabitants. Some 15,000 Jews, between 12 and 15,000 Jews. It was a Jewish town, which means on Saturday most shops were closed, and the town became very quiet, very calm. And on most streets, you could go from house to house, let's say Friday evening, and hear the same songs. And if you went from one street to the other, you will follow the song, actually. The first song, which is to invite the angels of peace to enter with us into the room, and greet the Sabbath, which is the day of peace, the night of peace, the time of peace. On high holidays, the same thing. Even the non-Jews knew Jewish laws. Even the non-Jews would, for instance, know never to offer a cake or bread or meat all year, but bread during Passover. And the Jews felt secure. Oh, from time to time, there were anti-Semitic incidents. You know, why should be different from other Jews in other places in those lands? On Easter, for instance, there were anti-Semitic hooligans who attacked young people or old people. And on Christmas, so we stayed home.
Before the outbreak of World War II, as a little boy, what did you think your grown-up life was going to be?
My ideal, my dream, was to be a writer, strangely enough, and a teacher, which I am now. Except I wanted to teach only Talmud and commentaries and become somewhere in a small place, in a small village, probably a Rosh Yeshiva, meaning a head of a Talmudic academy. That was my dream. And write commentaries on important sacred books. lo and behold, I'm a teacher and a writer. But I do not write the same things.
Well, as you write about yourself, you were a child interested in spiritual matters and even had a friend that you used to compete with to see, quote, who could be closer to heaven. Now, what was behind this competition?
Well, you want to be pious. We felt that you want to come close to God, not to people in power. Today, everybody wants to be close to people in power. We wanted to be close to God. And the only way to be close to God is really to be worthy of God's presence, meaning to behave in a certain way, to acquire a certain purity in our language, in our behavior, and in prayer. So we would obviously compete. Who would pray longer?
And who won?
I think both won and both lost.
Well, it really wasn't until 1944 when the war really came to Hungary. This was the German occupation of Hungary. As the war was going on, what kind of news penetrated into Sziget?
Well, I was too young and too obsessed with my study. Therefore, I didn't know much of what was happening in the world, except on Sabbath at the table my father would give some news. But then when the war broke out, first when Hitler invaded Czechoslovakia, there were Czech refugees. We were on the border. We bordered Czechoslovakia, Hungary, and then Poland. And the first refugees were Czech refugees. Then the Polish refugees. And the Polish refugees, because they crossed the border, which was not far from Sziget, they came with sometimes terrible news. I didn't know all that. I only knew that something was bad. Naturally, Hitler was evil. But I didn't know details.
Do you think your parents were protecting you?
No, I put myself. I could have listened to everything. I didn't read newspapers because why waste time on newspapers when you can read a Bible or the Talmud? Maybe it's true today too, by the way. But I didn't know, except in 1941, the Hungarians issued a decree that all those who couldn't prove their Hungarian citizenship were to be deported. And everybody in my town in Sziget really had the same right of citizenship, because except some didn't bother to go to declare or to register the birth of a child in a town hall. And therefore they couldn't prove that they were born. They were born there and they were taken as foreigners, and they were deported in 1941 to Galicia, to Kolomei, a place called Kolomei. And there were 1,000 of them or more, 1,100 from Sziget. I remember we went to the train to accompany them. We brought them gifts, food, clothing. They were mainly poor people. And only one person came back, and he was the beadle of my synagogue, a certain Moshe the beadle. And he began telling atrocious stories. He said, they all had to dig their own grave. And they were all killed, and I alone, like this messenger in the book of Job, he said, and I alone escaped to come and tell the tale. And this tale was brutal, cruel. We didn't believe him. Even I, who was his friend, and I loved to listen to his stories because they were stories, I didn't believe that these stories were true.
Elie Wiesel is our guest today, and he's just written his memoirs, All Rivers Run to the Sea. Elie Wiesel received the Nobel Peace Prize in 1986, and he currently teaches at Boston University. We're going to take a very short break, and then we're going to talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Elie Wiesel. His book is called Memoirs, All Rivers Run to the Sea. Well, after the German occupation of Hungary, you write about the fact that wearing the yellow star scarcely bothered you. The creation of the ghetto was, quote, almost a relief. Was that you? Or was that the Jews of Sziget, that they saw this as just the next step or a very benign act?
It was surely I and my young friends. For the adults, I don't know. I feel they also felt the same way, because why did we feel that way? Because we didn't know. Again and again I speak about that. The crime of indifference, the crime of silence with regard to Hungarian Jews was what? That we didn't know. The Hungarian Jewish community was the only one who could have been saved, because the deportation came so late. The first deportation occurred mid-May, which means 3 weeks away from D-Day.
Okay, and then this was 1944.
44. This community could have been saved, but nobody cared.
In May of 1944, who knew about the Final Solution?
What do you mean? In Washington?
In
New York? In Stockholm? In the Vatican? In Switzerland? Check the New York Times. Check the Philadelphia Inquirer. You will see that already in 42, late 42, they spoke about the Final Solution. The names Auschwitz were known, except to us. When we, from Sziget, from Hungary, came to Auschwitz, we saw the name Auschwitz, we had no idea what it meant. And therefore, the ghetto was a kind, offered us a secure shelter to be with Jews, not to have to see the German soldiers, the German SS, when they came, or to see the anti-Semites. We felt good in the ghetto, but the whole thing lasted a few weeks, that's all.
It's so hard to understand that, I guess, in 1995, how a story could be in newspapers in 1942 and not be known around the world.
Well, it was war, and papers didn't reach, New York Times didn't reach Sziget. Further, those who read didn't tell us. There were radios, but we had no access to radios. It was forbidden for a Jew to own a radio. And again, if, let's say, we could have remembered, let's say, Moshe, the Beadle, his warnings. But he was a Beadle, the lowest of his class. Why should we listen to a Beadle? We thought he was crazy because he lost his family somewhere. He was crazy. He lost his mind. And why believe him? Had, let's say, a Roosevelt broadcast an appeal to Hungarian Jewry, don't board the trains, you may be sure we would have taken his words seriously. Or Churchill, or Ben-Gurion.
Well, you had a housekeeper who tried to convince you to come with her to hide out from the Nazis.
Oh, brave Maria, I loved her and I still do. She represents what is best, not only in Christianity, but what is best in the human nature. Why should we listen, really, again, to a poor woman who lives now, who lived then in the mountains? Why should we believe what she said, her premonitions? Why should we follow her when the entire community still was in the ghetto? The main thing really was that also a kind of psycho-historical element had played into it, that Jews like to be together. And my father felt, as I did, not to desert the community. Whatever will happen to everybody will happen to us too. That's what we thought all the time.
How much are you haunted today? Because certainly you lost your parents, you lost siblings as well from the death camps. How much are you haunted by the question of what we would have done if we had known about the Final Solution?
Oh, I lost my parents and my little sister, but I am haunted by it all the time. All the time. And if I feel anger at times, it's really, that is the anger. Why our friends, the allies, the liberals, the great humanists in America, England, so forth, why they abandoned us? Why we didn't exist for them? Why they simply accepted already that we were no longer alive, although we were still living? That is something which hurts and will continue to hurt. I rarely spoke about it. You know, I've written almost 40 books. And about the Holocaust, I've written maybe 4 or 5. The only memoir from before was Night, a short, very short narrative on what happened to me. But even there, I didn't speak about my father or my mother or my little sister because it was too close. And I was afraid if I spoke, I would cry. Here in this memoir, I do, because years and years and years go by, and I would like some words to remain.
The convoys then began in May of 1944. When you and your family were boarded onto the cattle cars, where did you think you were going?
In the beginning, we thought we were going to a Hungarian labor camp in Hungary. That was the rumor, that we are not going to leave Hungary, that Hungary will protect us. After all, we were Hungarian citizens. Again, had we known even that we were being deported to Poland, many of us would have escaped to the mountains. The Russians were 20 miles away. And the ghetto it was easy to leave the ghetto, to sneak out of the ghetto, to quit and go into hiding. It was possible for many, many, many Jews in Sziget and elsewhere. But we didn't know. We thought we were going to Hungary, to a labor camp. And they even told us families will remain together. Again, the key word was together.
And yet you write, life in the cattle cars was the death of my adolescence, how quickly I aged. And I got the feeling that very soon after the cattle cars left, you realized that there was something much more horrifying waiting for you.
A premonition, especially when we left when we left the border and we entered Poland. A premonition was there. We didn't know its name nor its face, but it was there. The main fear was not to die or be killed, but to be separated.
Well, you arrived in Auschwitz. You were 15, and the men and women were separated from each other. You were separated from your mother and your sister and never saw them again.
I saw my older sisters, but not my little sister.
But
and
not
my mother.
Your little sister?
No. I see them in my dreams.
Well, I was wondering how much you think about them now?
Well, I think that most of us, or many of us at least, who went through this experience, now we dream more than before about that period. Maybe we try to retain certain events, certain words, certain smiles, certain tears. And since we cannot, we bring them back into our dreams.
I wonder, too, at the age of 15, and here you were in Auschwitz, what you thought then was the fate of your mother and your sisters. What did you think was going to happen to them when you looked around you?
It depends when. For the first few days, I was in a haze. But afterwards, we knew. We didn't talk about it, but we knew that they were no longer alive. We knew with certainty that the first night swallowed them in its flames.
Elie Wiesel's memoirs is entitled All Rivers Run to the Sea. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from Dutton, publisher of Road Warriors, Dreams and Nightmares Along the Information Highway by Daniel Burstein and David Klein. Celebrating 25 years of radio excellence, this is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with writer and Nobel Peace Prize winner Elie Wiesel. A Holocaust survivor, he has devoted his life to bearing witness. His new memoirs, All Rivers Run to the Sea, will be published next month. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane. My guest is Elie Wiesel, who has just written a memoir called All Rivers Run to the Sea. Wiesel spent a year in concentration camps and lost his parents and younger sister during the Holocaust. He's written more than 30 books in his mission to keep alive the memory of the Holocaust. In his new memoirs, he details his childhood growing up in Hungary, his memories of the horrors of Auschwitz and Buchenwald, and his years after the war, living and working in Paris. Wiesel's first book, Night, was written more than a decade after the end of the war. Well, let me just read something from the first book that you wrote called Night, and you wrote this back in the 60s. Never shall I forget that night, the first night in the camp, which has turned my life into one long night, seven times cursed and seven times sealed. Never shall I forget that smoke. Never shall I forget the little faces of the children whose bodies I saw turned into wreaths of smoke beneath a silent blue sky. Never shall I forget those flames which consume my faith forever. Never shall I forget that nocturnal silence which deprived me for all eternity of the desire to live. Never shall I forget those moments which murdered my God and my soul and turned my dreams to dust. Never shall I forget these things, even if I'm condemned to live as long as God himself. Never. You wrote that 30 years ago. Are the memories any less raw today?
30? I wrote them almost 50 years ago, 40 years ago. They are as, of course, as violent. And I stand by every word. My words have been misinterpreted, misunderstood very often. Some believe that I said I no longer believe in God. It's not really so. When I came to France, and you know, the major part of my memoirs are about after the war. This is because what I had to say, I said in Night, I added a few things here, but the major part is afterwards. How does one adjust to new life? And I re-became very religious. When I came to France from Buchenwald and I entered an orphanage, a kind of children's home, I re-became as religious as I was before, if not more so. It's only later when I began studying philosophy and I learned how to ask certain questions that I felt the need to protest. And I still protest, but I protest from within faith, not outside faith. It is permitted in the Jewish religion to take God to task and say, what is happening to your creation? And I'm doing it to this day. That doesn't mean I whitewash the human beings who are directly responsible or guilty. But I say God cannot be evacuated or omitted from the equation. What is happening up in heaven? So,
you had your father, in a sense, it was the two of you in the death camps. How were you able to take care of each other?
Oh, the best we could. We couldn't, but we tried. If you have nothing, you share nothing. But the nothing becomes also something that you can share. My father became the closest person I ever had in those places, in those times. I had no one else. He had no one else. And we were so terribly, marvelously close. Too close, perhaps, because when anything happened to him, it affected me and the other way around. I lived because I didn't want to die, for I knew if I died, he too would die. And I'm sure for him too. He wanted to live in order to see me alive. And with small things, so small. If I had, let's say, a piece of bread and I saw him hungry, I would give it to him and simply say, no, I had enough, or my stomach aches. And he did the same thing. And we would give each other the same piece of bread. Or I would ask him questions as if I needed his advice. There was no advice he could give me because we were all in the hands of the killers. And yet I asked for his advice simply because I wanted him to know that he's still my father, that he has the authority of the father, that I look up to him, that he decides what I will do. These things, and then he died, and then he died, and he keeps on dying.
Did you see goodness at Auschwitz and Buchenwald?
Yes. Of course, among the victims, there were some who maintained, most of them maintained their humanity. If the killers wanted to dehumanize the victims, they failed. They humanized themselves. Most victims maintained their humanity. Oh, it was a very poor humanity, a very miserable humanity that they had. What could they do then? They had no freedom. They had no place to hide from death. They lived in death. We weren't afraid of death, nor of dying, because we lived inside death.
You had talked about the importance of staying together. That was so important to your family. When your father died, you write, "I felt curiously free." What did you mean?
I mean free from that fear for him. Free that from now on I will not have to be afraid of what will happen to him. I had no more fears. It was the end of fear. It was the worst state in fear because it was the end.
You were more afraid of what would happen to him than to yourself?
Of course.
And you think he for you?
Absolutely.
You write about the fact that you lost all desire to live, and yet you lived. Do you know why?
I have no idea. Absolutely no idea. I don't think that I wanted to live. The last days, the last months after his death, I wasn't alive. I was living in a sort of apathy. I didn't see anything. That's why my pages on Buchenwald are very few. Yeah. Very few, because I didn't want to know. All I wanted really is somehow to be away in a non-being, in a state of non-being, which I was.
Well, I know that many survivors of the Holocaust have asked themselves the question about why they survived and others didn't. And I think many people are haunted by that question, not knowing, of course, what the answer is. Are you still haunted by that question?
Of course, because I could have died, especially in Buchenwald. And logically, I should have, because I never did, in my whole experience in the camps, I never did anything to live. Never. And by chance, it was by sheer accident that I remained always behind. When the gates opened, people left the last days of the camp on evacuation, and somehow I was behind.
Buchenwald was liberated, and you, your father, and you had been transferred to Buchenwald from Auschwitz. And as you say, Buchenwald liberated itself, and this was April 11th, 1945. You were 16 years old. What did that liberation mean for you? You were sick and certainly in a psychologically and physically weakened state.
Well, nevertheless, it meant we didn't absorb the meaning of freedom right away. There is what psychiatrists call a period of latency. Some experiences are so strong that you don't cope with them right away. It takes a time. It takes time, a year or a month or a day or an eternity until it hits you. But on the spot to see the American soldiers, I will never forget them. That's why I have a very soft spot in my memory and in my being for the American soldier. They were there. I saw them weeping. Mm. At that time, I had never seen an adult weep the way they did, simply because they saw us.
So they saw you probably in a different way than you even saw yourself.
Well, I didn't see myself. I had no mirror. But they saw us. And they saw the nakedness of the human condition.
You went to France after the war. Why France?
By accident again. I wanted to go back home, of course, but I had no home. And for a few weeks, we checked the lists of survivors, thinking maybe I would see a name of a sister, perhaps my older sister. And when I didn't see them, we were 400 children or youngsters or adolescents in that same situation. The youngest was 8, and he is now the chief rabbi of Israel. We would have gone anywhere. Some wanted to go to Palestine. Me too. I was ready to go to Palestine. I wanted to go to Palestine. But it was then British mandate. The gates were closed for all Jews. We came to France because de Gaulle heard about our drama and he invited us to come to France. So we came to France.
I'm curious how you were able to start your life again after having lost most of your family. And at that point, you thought you were an orphan. And certainly having been through the kind of experience that you've been through at both Buchenwald and Auschwitz, how does one start again?
First, one continues. One doesn't start again. As I told you, I became very religious. I opened the same tractate of a Talmud which I had interrupted in 1944. And I had friends. And we studied together. We prayed together. And life has a very strong appeal. The problem was not how to adjust to life. The problem was how to adjust to death. Because for us, before, that was nothing. That was the norm. Death. You slept with dead people. You didn't feel anything when you saw a dead corpse. And then you had to adjust to death. That is a scandal. That is always an outrage. An outrage to creation, an outrage to humanity. People shouldn't die. I would like to think of every human being that I meet as a candidate for immortality. And that was the difficulty. It took time. I didn't know a word of French then. I had to study French. Then went to the Sorbonne, studied there. Became a journalist, and all that, as I tried to describe it, was funny. At one point, it became funny. I fell in love. Every girl I met, I fell in love. Didn't last long, because it was never reciprocated. But I felt I needed not to love, not to be loved. I needed to love. I needed to know that I was capable of love. And therefore, I tell so many funny stories about me being in love. Then, as a journalist, but my experiences as a journalist, I had to readjust there to meet people more important than I. I remember an interview I had to conduct with a Miss Europe. I, who was so bashful that I blushed whenever I saw a girl, had to interview the most beautiful woman in Europe. And because I asked for an interview and it was arranged for me, and she had already a press agent probably. And I came to see her in her apartment. And it was hilarious because she was waiting for my questions. I didn't know what to ask. So I said to her the truth. I said, "Lady, I have never done it. It's not my field. My field is to interview political personalities or writers, but not beauty queens. What should I ask you?" So she said, "First of all, ask me what I ate today." I asked her what she ate and what kind of exercises and so forth. And then she gave me a few numbers. And I thought she gave me her telephone number. It was her measurements. Well, you can imagine what the success of such an interview and so forth. Really, therefore, except for the first chapter about the war, I wanted to show here that life afterwards had not only humor but also joy. And that is the absurd discovery one makes, that afterwards one is capable of joy, because one must give joy, not only receive it. If I don't receive it, I don't give it. If I don't give it, that means I have not received it. We live with people, and I cannot burden those that I like or those that I know or don't know all the time with my sad memories. It's wrong. So, therefore, all the rivers run to the sea.
My guest is Elie Wiesel. His memoir is entitled All Rivers Run to the Sea. More after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Elie Wiesel. He's just written his memoirs. When did you feel it was safe enough to write about what had happened in Buchenwald and Auschwitz?
I had made a vow in 1945 when I came to Paris. I began writing a diary, and these memoirs really are based on those diaries. I wrote every single day. But I decided also that I will not write about that period for 10 years. I took a vow of silence for 10 years. I want to be sure that the words that I use will be the proper words. I wanted to be sure that I will not cheat or lie or find some beautiful phrases simply because they are beautiful. And therefore, it took me 10 years.
And have you ever found the right words?
I do not think so. Truly so. I whenever I finish a book, I always know it's not what I wanted to say.
And that's because, what, there literally aren't words?
Exactly. There are no words.
You write in French, is that right? And your wife translates into English?
I write in French, and my wife for many, many years translated or occasionally works on translations, but the English has her imprint since I got married.
I'm curious why you write in French.
I don't know English that well, truly. I feel comfortable in French. At home, I used to speak Yiddish, and at school, Romanian and then Hungarian. I discovered a language which I needed. I needed it as one needs a new home, a new address, and a new code. And French became that code, that address, that home. And therefore, I remained with it. The first novel I read was in French. The first book on philosophy was in French. The first book on humor, philosophy of humor, was in French. So everything is in French.
The 50th anniversary of the Nuremberg trials is coming up, and I'm curious what that anniversary means to you.
Well, I remember it. I was already in France, and I remember it. I remember that, again, I was following it. I didn't know the French language yet, so I followed it in Yiddish, in the Yiddish papers. On one hand, I felt it was absolutely essential to have those responsible for these crimes judged and punished. But I felt it should not be an occasion to whitewash all the others, to take them and say the others are therefore innocent. At that time, there were so many people who had been accomplices. The accomplices, too, had to be judged. But politics, as always, entered the picture, and very soon, a few years later, the entire process of denazification was a closed chapter.
The trials then had particular impact on you personally, because I guess to outsiders it can look like an important ritual, but one that may not have the kind of resonance that it might have for someone like yourself.
Oh, it had, because for the first time, during those trials, for the first time, they showed pictures. And the pictures of the pictures actually are interesting, that all the Göring and so forth, for the only time during the trial when they felt uncomfortable was when they showed the pictures of the camps and the massacres and so forth. But I covered the Eichmann trial for American and French papers, for American Jewish papers and French papers. And that is the trial that I knew better. I was there. I watched it. And I remember when I came, I had hoped that Eichmann had 3 ears and 2 noses and 5 eyes. Mm. I had hoped that he is like a Picasso creature, that he wasn't a normal human being, that he was a monster, visibly a monster, that I could see, everybody could see, that he and I have nothing in common. I'm a human being and he is not. He's a monster. But he had 2 eyes. He even smiled occasionally. He ate well, slept well, had good appetite. He listened well. He defended himself. Strangely enough, except for one incident, he was never broken by the prosecution. He maintained his position to the end.
Have you been back to Sziget in Hungary?
Now it's Romania.
Now it's Romania.
Again,
yes.
Remember? I don't know what happened to this little city. Everybody wanted it, you know. It's such a small city. There's nothing interesting in it. But every nation wanted it. Every power came to occupy it. And they fight. They fought about it then, and they still fight about it now. I went back, yes, and it's... I went back for the first time. I didn't recognize it because it didn't change.
You had, though.
I had, but the child in me has not. I couldn't believe that nothing changed. The same streets, the same trees, the same benches in the park, and the same stores, everything the same except the Jews were not there. And when I came to my home, I recognized the squeak of the gate. And I was afraid, it was at night, I came there at night, I was afraid that the door may open, a window may open, or a door may open, and the child I used to be would come out and say, "What are you doing, you, in my dream?"
We just have a minute or two left. Do you see yourself as a victim or a survivor?
Oh, a victim? No, I'm not a victim. I don't believe in the victimhood of the victim. I think simply we all are witnesses. we are witnesses. As such, we have certain responsibilities to bear witness, to give testimony, not to allow the killer to kill his victims a second time. If the victims are forgotten, it will be our fault. The first death was the killer's crime. The second would be our fault, and that should not be.
Elie Wiesel's latest book is a memoir, All Rivers Run to the Sea. Wiesel received the Nobel Peace Prize in 1986. Music by Gideon Klein from the collection Chamber Music from Theresienstadt. This is Fresh Air. What's in a name? For some, just about everything. Linguist Jeff Numberg considers what some individuals and corporations will do just to leave their mark.
I got stuck in traffic the other day as I was driving down 101 past the ballpark formerly known as Candlestick. I had no one to blame but myself because I'd been listening to the traffic reports on the radio and they had reported the jam. The only problem was that they described it as a backup out by 3Com Park, and I just blanked on the name. You may have read about this. The San Francisco Board of Supervisors made the deal to rename the park for the next 6 months after the Silicon Valley Networking Company, with an option to renew the deal until the year 2000. Not surprisingly, a lot of the locals have been getting shirty about the change. As somebody said, that was the only damn thing the stick had going for it, was a neat name. Still, I suppose we'll all get used to 3Com Park out here, the way people seem to have gotten used to Coors Field in Denver and the Coors State Spectrum in Philadelphia and the Trans World Dome in St. Louis. Come to think of it, though, the folks in St. Louis must get nervous every time TWA verges on going back into Chapter 11. It's a risk here, too, I suppose, given the way the high-tech business has been going. We'll have just gotten into the habit of saying things like, you want to go out to the Dodgers game at the Com? And then 3Com will get taken over by somebody else. So we'll have to start talking about Cisco Systems Park or Microsoft Park or whatever. Come to think of it, there will probably be quite a few Microsoft Parks in America before the decade's out. Around the universities, they describe this sort of thing as a naming opportunity. Those are the most valuable pieces of real estate on campus, the lintels over the entrances to dormitories, auditoriums, and stadiums. It's a trickier business for them, of course. The Tostitos Fiesta Bowl people can change the name of the event if they get a better offer from the Granny Goose folks. But the donors who pay to put their names on college dormitories are after the attention of posterity and not simply the playoff audiences, so you can't go changing the names every few years or so. There's nothing new in any of this, of course, particularly in this hemisphere. That's how the New World must have struck the first European settlers, as a vast and virgin naming opportunity. Sometimes it seems that the motor force in all American history is just the eternal urge to stick your name on some feature of the landscape. from Baltimore to Levittown, from Harvard to Bob Jones University, from Francis Tavern to Rockefeller Center. The only difference is that nowadays we've gotten more efficient about spotting naming opportunities. Not an instant replay, not a museum cloakroom, not a bus shelter that doesn't have somebody's name attached to it. Of course, like all schemes for cheating death, this usually comes to nothing in the end, Americans being a singularly forgetful people. Still, there's always the hope that you may luck out. After all, the whole continent of America is named after a second-rate Johnny-come-lately Florentine navigator who wormed his way into the history books by convincing a German mapmaker to attach his name to the place. And I suppose it answers to a basic biological drive. I look at Trump Tower or Three Cum Park, I can't help thinking of my daughter's guinea pig, sweeping his grease gland over the floor of the cage so that anybody who happens by will know that Squeaky once passed this way.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at Stanford University and the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center. We were sorry to hear the news today of the death of composer and lyricist Ralph Blaine. He died yesterday at his home in Oklahoma. He was 81. He and Hugh Martin made up the songwriting team of Martin and Blaine. They wrote one of Hollywood's most beloved musicals, Meet Me in St. Louis. It included the songs Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas, The Trolley Song, and the song you're about to hear, The Boy Next Door. Here's Ralph Blaine singing.
How can I ignore the girl next door? I love her more than I can say. Doesn't try to please me, doesn't even tease me, and she never sees me glance her.
Ralph Blaine. We'll hear Terry's 1989 interview with Ralph Blaine and Hugh Martin on Friday's archive edition of Fresh Air. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Alan Tu, Kathy Wolf, and Barbara Bogave. Research assistance from Rena Bander. For Terry Gross, I'm Marty Moss Cohen.
Clang, clang, clang went the trolley. Ding, ding, ding went the bell. Zing, zing, zing went my heartstrings from the moment I saw him, I fell.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Times Books, publisher of The Secrets of Mariko, A Year in the Life of a Japanese Woman and Her Family by Elizabeth Buemiller. Celebrating 25 years of radio excellence, this is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a father investigates the murder of his daughter. The father, Washington Post reporter George Lardner, has written the book The Stalking of Kristen, which looks into his daughter's death and the man who killed her. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.